Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the exit of Governor Scott Walker from the Republican presidential primary race, with an announcement exhorting his rivals still in the crowded field to drop out so that a limited number of candidates can offer an alternative to the frontrunner, who he did not name. John Nichols, the Nation magazine's Washington correspondent and the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, joins us to discuss what happened to Walker's early lead and whether any other candidate will take Walker's advice now that the latest polls have him at less than 0.5% that would exclude him from even being at the kids' table in the next debate. Then we'll look into the historic shift in Japan's military posture that was a huge issue in Japan and provoked alarmed responses from China and South Korea, but has elicited very little interest and scant coverage here in the United States. Ellis Krauss, Professor Emeritus of Japanese Politics and Policymaking at the University of California, San Diego, and author of Beyond Bilateralism, U.S.-Japan Relations in the New Asia-Pacific, joins us. We'll discuss what the abandonment of Japan's post-war pacifist posture will mean for a region where tensions often erupt over disputed islands. Then finally, we will speak with Paul Eisenstein, the editor and publisher of thedetroitbureau.com, who has over 30 years of experience covering the auto industry. We will try to understand why Volkswagen rigged tests results on 11 million VW diesel cars that were sold worldwide, with vehicles sold in the U.S. receiving a green energy rebate that cost the taxpayer $51 million for cars that were emitting 40 times the pollutants they were supposed to be trapping. And joining us now from Wisconsin is John Nichols, who is the Nation magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and the author with Robert McChesney of It's the Media, Stupid, Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections and Destroys Democracy, and their latest book, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
Well, thank you for that generous introduction, my friend. I think you went through our entire bookshelf.
Well, I'm actually calling you for a kind of requiem on Governor Scott Walker, who pulled out of the presidential race yesterday. But in doing so, he made the most peculiar kind of appeal. Quoting, I encourage other candidates to do the same, meaning get out, so that the voters can focus on a limited number of candidates who can offer a positive conservative alternative to the current front runner. Of course, not naming him, but referring to Donald Trump. This is fundamentally important to the future of the party and, more importantly, to the future of the country. Now, these candidates don't like each other, so is there any chance in the world that they're going to take Scott Walker's advice, the sage advice of a loser?
Of course not. I mean, in fact, you know, imagine this concept. Scott Walker is saying, I want to lead by quitting, right?
Right.
In what, I mean, you, Ian, I know that you chose to come to this country. You're not born here, if I'm correct, right?
That's true.
But
yes.
I think you've been here long enough to understand and perhaps imbibe a little bit of our sports culture, the metaphors of our sports, which happen to form virtually, unfortunately, all the metaphors for politics. Did you ever hear anybody say, you know, when the chips are down, quit? You know, or, you know, quitters never lose and losers never win. Or, you know, I mean, it's like Orwellian stuff. It is an absolutely bizarre statement. Well, and he asks others. The incredible thing about it is he says something that's just bizarre and out of sync and dysfunctional. And then his core appeal is, join me in this. It was laughable. And the interesting thing is, I think that every other Republican, right, every other candidate who's in the weak position that Scott Walker is, and there's quite a few of them who are very low in the polls, I mean, they're glad he's gone, because at the, you know, at that kids' table where they're all forced to debate, you know, there's a little more, they have a few more scraps of, you know, potential campaign donors, potential county chairs, potential somebody to campaign for him someplace. And the notion that anybody would get out when he leaves is politically absurd.
But he got half of 1%, or less than half of 1%, in the most recent poll that followed the elections, where he was at the adults' table, not at the kids' table. But
right.
As far as I can tell, a half a percent would definitely put you, you know, not even at the kids' table, at the table of outside for the servants, you know.
You're heading out of the room. And remember, this is the painful reality. Don't underestimate that. The standards that have been established, which, by the way, are absurd and you know, it's just completely arbitrary, but the standards that have been established for getting into debates include a, you know, a threshold. And that threshold is under 1%. It's if you're at zero. They knocked former Virginia governor, former Republican National Committee Chair Jim Gilmore out of the last kids' table debate. They said, you know, yeah, you were one of our most prominent elected officials. You were a key figure in the national party, but you're not polling high enough to sit at the table. You're not polling enough to get to one of these podiums, right? And Walker, who once was the front runner, and we should understand that there was a brief period there where he was literally the front runner in this race, polling as well as Donald Trump is today. Walker was faced with the prospect of not going to the kids' table, but literally being, you know, sitting at some bar with Jim Gilmore. He needed to get out. There was simply no question. This guy had to get out at this point. And it was just a matter of how you do it. I will, you know, we've talked about Walker before. I don't pay that guy a lot of compliments, but I will pay him a compliment in this regard. He looked at his circumstance, and he did the politically smart thing. Instead of saying, I'm going to go into my PAC money and try and, you know, make one last-ditch effort to pivot, I'm going to try some way to resurrect this campaign, he realized there was no way to fix this thing, and so he quit. That was smart. But the final thing on this is understand why he quit. It's the most important part of this whole storyline. He quit because he had absolutely no message that could appeal to the voters in the Republican fight. And that's because his only identifier, his only definition, was as a union buster, as some sort of anti-union zealot. And everybody knew that, and he kept going back to it and talking about it. Just the other day, he launched some big anti-union program, and nobody cared. There was no excitement in that. And what Scott Walker has proven is that while it is absolutely true that most Republicans probably aren't particular fans of unions, very few Republicans think of deconstructing unions, attacking the labor movement, attacking living wages, things like that, that should be the centerpiece of their party. Republicans themselves aren't excited by that, and Walker just proved it. So he did a service to humanity, and we should probably thank him for that.
And again, I'm speaking with John Nichols, who is in Wisconsin, where he's the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent and the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. He's the author with Robert McChesney of It's the Media Stupid, Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. And their latest book is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Now, one of the sort of explanations that in some of the punditry I've read about Walker's withdrawal is that he peaked too early. But surely there's another interpretation, and that is that he finally, after, you know, being ahead of the polls way back in January, it's not as if this election's not long enough as it is, and we're, you know, in this coming November, which is a couple of months away, it'll be a whole year. But nevertheless, that's been the explanation, that he peaked too early. But my sense is that, frankly, all that happened was that because he had more scrutiny, and particularly up on the stage with his competitors, the Republican voters saw what I've seen for a long time, and I perhaps you have too, John Nichols. There's no there.
He's an empty suit. Yeah. Yeah, this is the, you're exactly right. That's precisely it. Although let's tweak it out one more level and say that what Scott Walker got was an entry card, a welcome to the upper tiers of this campaign. He was invited into the front runner circle to be at the top. He wasn't invited there by the voters. It wasn't like he had gone around the country for 2 or 3 years, shaken a lot of hands, and actually impressed the voters at the base level, you know, classic grassroots Republicans. No, he had impressed the donor class. He impressed billionaires like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and other very, very wealthy people. And he impressed the right-wing media echo chamber that extends from the donor class. And in that circle, being virulently anti-union is a big deal. They think that's really great, and they get all excited about that. That's why when Scott Walker got in trouble in Wisconsin, they focused the entire right-wing media as well as the entire right-wing money machine into protecting him in one state. But once he got to the national level, they did do him a great favor. They gave him, he piled up a lot of money early on. He had plenty of resources to travel around. They also gave him incredibly favorable write-ups in, you know, all of their media. They talked about him very, very favorably. For quite a while, Rush Limbaugh was essentially, you know, talking up Scott Walker at a higher level than any of the other candidates. That entry card allowed him to finally be at a point where he wasn't just talking to the donors and the media echo chamber. He was actually talking to the voters. And at the point where Republican grassroots activists started to focus on the campaign, they asked a simple question, a one-word question. Why? Why should we make you our nominee? Why should we literally, you know, blood, sweat, and tears push for you to become the next president of the United States of America? And what he did was repeat old war stories from, you know, battles with over collective bargaining in Wisconsin, and frankly, show himself to be a bit of a goofball because he literally said, you know, pushing around nurses and teachers and librarians in Wisconsin, not listening to them, had prepared him to take on the most daunting global challenges. Right. And it was just sort of like one track, you know, kind of one trick pony thing. People looked at that, and I think they said, this is ridiculous.
Right. Make me president, and I'll lower your standard of living, too. I mean,
yeah,
what a
but,
message.
But even if you didn't get to that level of insight, Ian, you know, that this would actually harm you economically, even if it was just, okay, entertain me, tell me something interesting, he just kept on the kind of same vapid old stuff that they frankly knew about anyway, even grassroots voters. And here's the interesting thing. So one of those tragic things in rock and roll is like a one-hit wonder, somebody who had a hit maybe in the 1950s, and they try to make a comeback in the 1970s, remixing their hit as a disco song, right? Mm-hmm. And they're out there on American Bandstand with their shirt unbuttoned and their hair grown out a little, trying to be hip and trying to, you know, extend the one-hit wonder from the 50s. And, you know, it always failed. It never worked. And that's what Scott Walker is. He's a one-hit wonder who went on the national stage, tried to remix his hit into something that could, you know, make him the nominee of his party and the president of the United States. And people said, you know, you kind of look tragic. And they shot him down to one half of 1% in the polls.
Well, just to go through some of the history, and I'd like to get on to more current things and more important things, frankly. You know, I recall he tried to make himself look like a statesman by going to Europe, and in London he mentioned he couldn't even answer what his views on evolution were. He couldn't answer whether or not Obama is a Christian. He flip-flopped on ethanol in Iowa, which is a big ethanol state. He said that only a handful of Muslims were reasonable. He proposed building a wall with Canada, to match Donald Trump's wall on the Mexican border. And then, because he was all over the place on the birthright citizenship issue. But the thing that really I recall most of all, and it just seemed like the worst of these horrible politicians who think that somehow that you have to beat up on a bunch of your fellow Americans. And the lowest of all is the idea that people on welfare have to take blood tests implication that they're all a bunch of drug addicts, when there have been studies and surveys done and investigations done into welfare recipients, and there's absolutely no evidence that most welfare recipients are drug addicts. So that's the thing that really I found despicable about him. I mean, apart from a lot of other things.
I'll give you one more if you want to add something to your list.
Right.
He's been governor now for 5 years, and essentially almost 5 years. He's never issued a pardon.
Huh.
Even when people have come with, really good arguments for, a guy got in trouble as a kid and, it's really cleaned his life up, a woman who maybe shoplifted years ago but now really wants to, get back to full citizenship and all the, get dot every I, cross every T, he refuses it. I mean, Pope Francis is here in America, and whether people agree with the tenets of his religion or of his own personal ministry, folks are impressive. They seem to like him very much. He polls better than anybody ran for president. And I think one of the reasons is that he seems humane, forgiving, relatively decent human being. And in fact, maybe even a model of some humanity and a willingness to take stands on issues that are controversial at times, but to do so seemingly, I think, in the interest of humanity, at least especially on some of his economic and climate change stances. And then you take Scott Walker, a guy who, he just failed miserably in politics. And you ask, well, why didn't people like him? What was our feeling about him? Was it his stance on the issue? Yes, some of his stance on the issues were absurd, and wrong. But also, I just think he seemed like an incredibly unforgiving person. He seemed like somebody who really wasn't going to ever see the possibility that there were those who needed a little help from their government, needed a little protection, maybe needed the ability to form a union so that they could bargain collectively for a slightly better pay. It's not to, I'm not here to make any sort of crude or simplistic comparison between any politician and any religious leader. I think that's absurd. It's just to say, what do people respond to? I think sometimes we get lost in thinking about ideology and partisanship, and we forget that what people respond to very well, quite often, at their best, is a genuineness, a sense that you really do believe in what you're doing, and even if I don't agree with you, at least it's sincere. With Scott Walker, I never had a sense that he was genuine.
Well, in the last minute or so, John Nichols, let's turn to the Democrats. And the fact that the other day, I think it was in New Hampshire, Hillary Clinton fired a shot across Joe Biden's bow. I think she was asked a question about student loans. And she said that at one point when she was in the Senate with Biden, she was going to vote against a student loan deal. As you know, the banks get money from the Fed at a quarter of 1%. And the banks then charge that back in terms of student loans at 6% and 7%. They just make money right off the top. And Hillary Clinton said she was going to vote against that, but then Biden twisted her arm because he represents Delaware, where all these banks are, and decided to vote along with him. And she was sorry she did that. And the way I saw that was, well, maybe she's just firing a sort of warning shot at Biden, saying, if you enter this race, I'm gonna mess you up. What's your interpretation? Because it looks as if he's going to enter the race. And to my mind, with the Democrats thinking that they've got it won because of Donald Trump is destroying the Republicans, Biden's entry into the race will probably do the same for the Democrats.
Well, it's potential that Joe Biden runs. It's covered him for a long time. I would counsel you that, you know, he is looking at getting into the race. I think there's no doubt of that. But that's a hard leap for a variety of reasons. Number one, he's not a kid. He's well into his 70s. Obviously, Bernie Sanders has proven that there's not an age limit. But number two, he is not that different from Hillary Clinton on a lot of issues. And, you know, maybe there she was trying to distinguish a little on something, but she didn't do a very good job of it. And so this notion that he's going to get in and suddenly claim the race, I'm not sure of that. And I do think that's something he's going to weigh. Joe Biden, I think, will continue to delay the possibility of a candidacy until after the first Democratic debate. Now, I may be wrong about this, and obviously there's a date stamp there, so I'll be proven wrong if it's not the case. But I think Joe Biden will delay until after that debate, until after Hillary Clinton testifies before Congress about the Benghazi stuff, or something they got her up there. I'm sorry, is it emails? I sometimes lose track of which one they want her up there on. But, you know, they're going to bring her up for some testimony. And I think by the end of October, you're going to see one way or the other whether Hillary Clinton can do this thing, right? Whether she's really kind of shown it. A good debate performance, strong congressional testimony where she pretty much shuts down her critics. You know, if she does that, I don't think that Joe Biden gets in. On the other hand, if October's a lousy month for Hillary Clinton, if it just doesn't work for her, then I think that there's a very real chance that he does it. But he doesn't do it to push her out of the race, I believe, so much as to step in at a point where it's pretty clear that it isn't going to work for her. And so I see him playing a waiting game, and not as a certain entry, but as a possible entry.
Well, John Nichols, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a great pleasure to be with you. It's John.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. He is the author, with Robert McChesney, of It's the Media Stupid, Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. And their latest book is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And he joined us from Wisconsin. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into an historic shift in Japan's military posture. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ellis Krauss, who's Professor Emeritus of Japanese Politics and Policymaking at the University of California, San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. He is a leading expert on Japanese politics and U.S.-Japan relations, and is a co-author of The Rise and Fall of Japan's LDP, Political Party Organizations as Institutions, and Beyond Bilateralism, U.S.-Japan Relations in the New Asia-Pacific. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ellis Krauss.
Glad to be here, Ian. Thank you.
And the fact that there's been this historic shift in Japan's military posture, it was, of course, a huge issue in Japan. It provoked an alarmed response from both China and South Korea. But it seems to have elicited very little interest in scant coverage here in the United States. Why? Am I correct in that, Ellis?
Well, there has been some coverage. I think maybe the BBC in England covered it more than many American papers. Media, I certainly didn't see very much of it on American television news. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that the coverage was particularly astute about what is going on in Japan. For me, at least, much of the media seemed to accept the opposition's point of view and spend when they did spend time on it, spent more time covering that and also mislabeled what is really going on in Japan.
So is that to say then that the bill passed on Friday, apparently it doesn't change the Article 9 language, the restriction that was put in the Constitution, but it sort of reinterprets it to allow for collective self-defense. So is that what you're saying?
That is true. Yes, but and also that the thing that the assumption that people seem to be going on, both in the opposition in Japan and the coverage in the American media, is that somehow this is unprecedented, that somehow this has never been, the Constitution has never been reinterpreted since it was put into effect during the American occupation of Japan in 1947. In fact, it's been constantly reinterpreted, certainly since the 1980s. The ruling Liberal Democratic Party that ruled Japan for most of the post-war period since 1955 has reinterpreted the Constitution several times. And so this is not new. It is a stretch of the constitutional interpretation. There's no question about that. But it's not the first one, nor do I personally think that it is a terribly as dramatic a one as the opponents seem to think. And I may add, just to set the record straight, I'm not a great fan of Prime Minister Abe. I happen to think that his stance on historical memories is counterproductive and undermines Japan's own self-interests in the region. But I do think that his reinterpretation of these bills and these new bill of the Constitution and these new bills is not as great a change as the opponents make it out to be.
But given what you just said about Prime Minister Abe, it is hard to understand that kind of obdurate, sort of boneheaded insistence on the part of Japanese conservatives that what happened in World War II in terms of atrocities in China and with POWs in the rest of the Pacific theater didn't happen. That's a very troubling thing. So if you combine that that alleged mindset, if you will, with this reinterpretation of the military posture, then I can see why people are alarmed.
Oh, absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right that the connection between these two, or at least the fact that people, it's Abe himself that is, I think, part of the problem. He has primed the public to see him as a extreme right-wing conservative. He is a conservative and he is right-wing. I don't think he's as extreme as the opponents make him out to be. He's a practical politician as well. But the fact that he's become a symbol of the extreme right, that he's supported by the extreme right in Japan, and that he himself has stated that he would like the Constitution to be revised, has all fed his opponents fire in many ways against him, because they see him as a symbol of the extreme right, including his historical memory stances, which make no sense to me whatsoever, by the way. I think, as I said, they're totally undermining of Japan's own self-interest. They distort and deny reality, and they damage Japan's relations with South Korea and China, which Japan needs economically. So it is this combination, I think, that is feeding the fuels. What is ironic, Ian, is that Abe admires his very conservative grandfather, who was prime minister in the late 50s, who pushed through the revision of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty in 1960, producing much huger riots and demonstrations than the current ones, by the way. 500,000 people were out in the street in one day during the 1960 treaty crisis. This is nothing like that, but it is one of the most vociferous protests in Japan since then. And the irony is that Abe admires his grandfather greatly, and in some ways he's become like him. And that is, Kishi, his grandfather, exacerbated the crisis in 1960 by both mishandling it as well as by becoming a symbol of far-right extremism, because he was an unindicted war criminal under the occupation. So I think in many ways Abe has unintentionally repeated his grandfather's pattern in this crisis.
And again, I'm speaking with Alice Krauss, who's Professor Emeritus of Japanese Politics and Policymaking at the University of California, San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. He's a leading expert on Japanese politics and U.S.-Japan relations and co-author of The Rise and Fall of Japan's LDP, Political Party Organizations as Institutions, and Beyond Bilateralism, U.S.-Japan Relations in the New Asia Pacific. And the response from the Chinese Foreign Ministry to this change in Japan's military posture was, quoting, "We demand that Japan genuinely listen to just appeals from both at home and abroad, learning from historical lessons and adhering to a path of peaceful development." But let's talk a bit about...
Would you like my reaction to that?
Sure. I just wanted to... Go ahead.
And the South Koreans protested too. This is totally expected. They are all riled up about the historical memories, and again, this is where these two cross and where Abe is getting, in part, some of his comeuppance for his stand on historical memories. South Korea and Japan are natural allies. They should be allies, and Abe's historical memory stance has undermined that possibility. China is a different story. China is going to protest this no matter what. China does not want to see Japan move closer to the U.S. militarily for obvious reasons. This bill, although aimed in part at North Korean possible contingencies, is also quietly also aimed at the possibility of conflict with China. So it is not unexpected that China would protest this. I really don't pay much attention to this. The big surprise would be if China did not protest this. They do it all the time whenever Japan increases its defense posture.
Well, Japan's defenses themselves are fairly robust. It has a pretty big military. It sort of has gone somewhat under the radar. I guess a lot of it to do with its GDP. And the same is true of China. Of course, now China is slowing down a little bit. So much of the alarm that there was about China's military potential, I think maybe is a bit of a hard sell now. But had they stayed on their trajectory of this huge growth path because of the percentage of GDP that would go to the military, you could make projections that they'd have a powerful military, neither of which, of course, has anything that even resembles the U.S. military.
Right. But on the other hand, Ian, there is some evidence, and of course we don't know for sure because it is not an opaque budget process, but there is evidence that the Chinese military has been growing faster than the GDP in recent years. And also, even at a 6 or 7% growth rate, which is what is being projected now after the downturn in China, that's a pretty hefty increase in military budgets. And China already has some significant military capability, enough so that the United States is quite worried. Japan cannot stand up to China by itself any longer. This is quite clear. And only a combined U.S.-Japan alliance has the possibility of deterring Chinese adventurism or China's possible military adventures in the region. So this is the great contradiction in Japanese public, I think, and that is they're petrified about North Korea, they're petrified about China. There's some polls that show that they're very happy for the U.S.-Japan alliance, even more so now because of the rise of China as a military power and because of the adventurism of North Korea. And yet at the same time, they're opposing the very bills that would make the alliance more robust to protect Japan. And so I think this is a very deep contradiction within the Japanese public itself. So, again, this is not a major change. It is a change. It is still geared towards self-defense rather than Japan being a normal military power. And that is the heart of the essence of the Constitution as it's been interpreted by the Japanese Supreme Court and by all previous Japanese administrations. This is not changing. All that's changing is it gives Japan the ability to help the U.S. protect Japan in with a smoother, more functional coordination. That is the really only major change. I should add that I was at a conference in Tokyo in May. We listened to some former admiral and former general of the self-defense forces in Japan, which is about 250,000 men, by the way, and has some very robust air and particularly naval defense. And both the admiral and the general were quite clear that it's going to take a few years before the self-defense forces can even ramp up to fulfill the mission that these bills is now setting for them. So the military in Japan is not yet at the point where it can even do what these bills are telling it it is now legitimate to do.
But there's obviously no comparison between the threat from North Korea and the threat from mm-hmm. China, although North Korea is more unpredictable. It's the tyranny of the weak, as one of the Korean experts' book indicates. Mm-hmm. But obviously, this change will mean that the U.S. Can shoot down a North Korean missile from Japanese territory, or vice versa. They can.
It had that ability, and it had that ability prior to this. Japan and the U.S. have been developing ballistic missile defense for over 10 years now, and they were prepared to deploy it at the time that North Korea last year, threatened to shoot another missile over Japan. If that missile had come over Japan, as it turned out it didn't, the U.S. and Japan were prepared to shoot it down. This bill does not change that.
I see.
In terms of the ability of Japan now to shoot down a missile aimed at the United States, I'm told by experts that that is not a current capability, although it may be at some point. That missile would have to pretty much fly right over Japan for Japan to do anything about that. And I think that that was a no-brainer anyway, even without these bills. Let us imagine a situation where North Korea fired a missile at the U.S. that flew directly over Japan. Japan and the U.S. combine their ballistic missile defenses, have the ability to shoot it down, possibly when it came over Japan. What would happen if Japan did not shoot that missile down and it landed in the U.S.? Obviously, that's the end of the U.S.-Japan alliance. On the other hand,
it may be the beginning of World War III, too.
Exactly. And it's the end of the U.S.-Japan alliance, because you imagine the United States Congress wanting to continue an alliance relationship protecting Japan when it would not even help protect against a missile fired at the U.S.
Sure.
And causing human institutional casualties. And if Japan does shoot it down, it's engaging in collective self-defense anyway. So either way, this bill really only, in some ways, legitimizes what was the case in any event. And I think this is what the Japanese public just does not understand, that this is not, as I keep repeating, this is not a major change. The Constitution has been reinterpreted before. The Prime Minister Koizumi in 2001 sent destroyers to the Indian Ocean to help in the war against terror in Afghanistan, although in non-combat roles. Japan has sent self-defense forces to Iraq for reconstruction, again in non-combat roles. The only change is that this gives the self-defense forces, if Japan is directly threatened, the ability to help protect U.S. assets protecting Japan. And that's the real heart of these bills, I think. And the public is making much more out of them than they really is there.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ellis Krauss.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Ellis Krauss, who's Professor Emeritus of Japanese Politics and Policymaking at the University of California, San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. He's a leading expert on Japanese politics and U.S.-Japan relations and co-author of The Rise and Fall of Japan's LDP, Political Party Organizations as Institutions, and Beyond Bilateralism, U.S.-Japan Relations in the New Asia-Pacific. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why VW rigged the tests. あの交差点でみんながもしスキップをして、もしあの街の真ん中で手をつないで空を見上げたら、もしもあの街のどこかでチャンスが。
trucking, run together, more or less in line. Just keep trucking on, on, on.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Eisenstein, who has over 30 years of experience covering the auto industry for a broad range of media. He is the editor and publisher of thedetroitbureau.com and a CNBC contributor. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Eisenstein.
Very good to be with you.
And Paul, I'm trying to understand why Volkswagen rigged these test results on 11 million VW diesel cars that were sold worldwide. And here in the United States, the vehicles that were sold received a green energy rebate that cost the taxpayer $51 million for cars that were actually emitting 40 times the pollutants they were supposed to be trapping. So this is a massive hoax, and I don't understand what they thought they were doing and why they did what they did.
Well, Volkswagen is extremely dependent on diesels. In Europe, most manufacturers sell more diesels than they sell regular gasoline vehicles, and VW wanted to sell some of those same vehicles here. To get there, they had to overcome a lot of resistance. You may recall back in the 80s, diesels all but disappeared from the U.S. market, in part because they were pretty dirty. They were also slow, smelly, you know, not much fun to drive. The modern diesel is a lot cleaner. It's faster. It doesn't shake as much. But the challenge was meeting these tough new federal emissions standards and the California standards. So the best we can guess is this. VW either didn't want to spend the money on taking things to the next level to make sure that those vehicles would meet the standards and meet customer expectations in terms of performance and mileage and everything, or they simply couldn't figure out how to do it on a consistent basis. But the bottom line was they took a shortcut. They built software in. The EPA calls it a defeat device. And what they've done is essentially when you're testing a vehicle on a treadmill, which is how it's normally done, the equivalent of a treadmill, something called a dynamometer, it knows and it activates all its pollution control equipment and it meets the standards. When it gets off that treadmill, as it were, when you're driving it on the street, suddenly you're putting out anywhere from the same amount as legal to as much as 40 times more pollution than allowed.
And the pollutant in this case is nitrous oxide, right, which is extremely damaging to the lungs and to people's health. And that's the whole idea. They had the device that could trap the NOx, but it didn't really trap it, right? And is there such a device that would do both of the things, which is trap the pollutant and give you the performance?
Yeah, there is. And if we look at some of the other manufacturers out there, by the way, before I get into that, the reality is there are two pollutants that are particularly difficult to control. One is the oxide of nitrogen problem, smog-causing gas, which, of course, is a major problem here in California. But the other is also particulates, very, very fine matter that has been linked to lung cancer. So those are the things that they want to block. Can they do it? Yes. As long as every other manufacturer selling diesels in the U.S. isn't cheating, and I think you're going to find the EPA taking a closer look at everybody going forward. But as long as everybody else isn't cheating, it seems like a lot of companies can meet the standards. Apparently, it may cost more than what VW was willing to spend on its products.
So this is really then a massive fraud that they had to know about at the highest level, right? This was not a decision made by a bunch of junior engineers.
In the German system, I would be stunned if this was done at the lower level. Sometimes things get done in corporations. At lower levels, people have mandates to meet, and they don't know how to do it, and they say, just do what you have to. It appears at General Motors that the top managers did not know. The Justice Department seems to have concluded that the top of the company did not know about the problems with the ignition switch. That seemed to have been held at mid-level. But I think we're going to wind up seeing a trace that goes all the way from the bottom to the top at VW.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Eisenstein, who has over 30 years of experience covering the auto industry for a broad range of media. He is the editor and publisher of thedetroitbureau.com and a CNBC contributor. So, Paul, obviously the EPA found this out, and now the DOJ is going to look into it. And we know that Volkswagen shares are taking a hell of a hit at the moment. Obviously, the only people who might be happy about this at the moment are General Motors, who just last week paid out $900 million for a number of deaths that their products had caused. Toyota, of course, had a scandal about a year ago as well. I think they paid out $1.2 billion, didn't they? So
yeah, plus billions more in terms of lawsuits. And the reality is, VW said today they've put aside, $6 billion to cover the likely costs of this this scandal. They could be technically liable to over $18 billion in fines from the EPA. We don't expect them to pay that much. The Department of Justice has indicated it's looking into this. Who knows? That could be $1 billion or more of a fine there, and we could see criminal charges in this case because there was such an overwhelming, there's evidence anyway, of an overwhelming effort to conceal things from the government. There are at least two class action lawsuits that have been filed. Who knows how much money that's going to cost? California could fine the company additionally. And now we're starting to see investigations everywhere from South Korea to the European Union.
So they've actually set aside 6.5 billion euros, which is about $7.3 billion, apparently. But this is, at least in the initial announcement by VW, this has been set aside for service costs, meaning, I guess, replacing or whatever they have to do to get rid of this piece of software that tricked everybody into believing that these cars were a lot greener than they were. What will this money do, though? Will it do what they originally pretended they were doing, which is giving you performance plus not polluting the air?
Oh, that's a big question, because here's the issue. VW has to not only be able to either reprogram the software or do even more extensive fixes to these engines, but it's also going to have to be able to deliver to those almost 500,000 customers vehicles that meet their other expectations. One of the reasons people like diesels is they have great performance as well as supposedly low emissions and high mileage. That's one of the advantages, technically, over, say, a hybrid. Well, if you came to me as an owner and said, well, you know what, we can fix this, we can make it pollute less, but we're going to cut the 0 to 60 times, and we're going to take 5 miles a gallon off the fuel economy, I would say buy the car back from me. And, you know, we've seen situations like this. Chrysler right now, Fiat Chrysler, was recently in a settlement with NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, in which it's going to actually offer to buy back vehicles from people who aren't satisfied with the potential fixes needed to meet certain safety recalls.
So I take it that, in effect, I think you more or less indicated this, Paul Eisenstein, that what they were doing, VW, is that they were competing with the Prius and the other hybrids that are getting a lot of market share, and they have a different way of doing it with these new diesel, clean diesel engines. A lot of them are turbocharged, aren't they? And the idea would be that because you get a better mileage with the diesel, you're polluting less, and you're not necessarily getting the same mileage as a hybrid, but you're getting better performance.
Well, you know, if you look at the sales numbers outside of California, hybrids aren't selling. And even in California, vehicles like the Prius are losing a lot of sales and market share lately with cheap gas. On the other hand, diesels continue to gain sales over the last couple of years, even with cheap gas, because they do offer supposedly this combination of low emissions, strong performance, and higher mileage. So in many cases, people who wouldn't normally be willing to go that extra mile, if you will, to go green, are willing to go diesel because they think they're getting all the benefits. Interestingly enough, when the EPA runs the fuel economy tests, hybrids almost always tend to come in the real world, lower than what the EPA ratings are. Almost always, diesels get real-world highway mileage better than what the EPA says.
But the point is that this is a something of an illusion, though, right? At least with VW.
You hit it right there. It's an illusion with VW. The reality is there are a number of other manufacturers that, as far as anybody knows at this point, are telling the truth, are using legitimate measurements, using legitimate software to control their emissions, and are meeting the emission standards and are delivering great performance and delivering fuel economy, great fuel economy. I mean, among the other brands are BMW and Mercedes-Benz, for example. General Motors has started to add a few diesels to their lineup. Chrysler has a couple of very popular ones, including one for their big Ram pickup. And there are other manufacturers that are looking to get into diesel as well. One of the questions is, will this give such a black eye to the image of diesels that it may short-circuit growing sales?
Well, one of the things that you notice, and I believe that there's something being done about it, because I think they've changed the composition of diesel, haven't they, the oil refineries. But it used to be that when you drive on the freeway, you'd see these buses and these big trucks just belching this black diesel. What's happening in that regard? I've heard that a lot of these big interstate haulers, and after all, most of our produce and food and goods in this country, shipped by 18-wheelers. Is there something happening in that regard in terms of hybrids?
Well, there's a bunch of things that have happened in terms of diesel, first of all. Among other things, the modern automotive diesel is almost always a turbocharged diesel. That's where you get the extra performance. They have technologies, I won't bore you with the details, things like common rail and ultra-high pressure fuel injection and so on. That plus the fact that the EPA a few years back ordered a huge reduction in the amount of sulfur in our diesel fuel has meant that even older vehicles are now belching a lot less smoke. Even older models that got worse pollution than we would allow today have cleaned up a fair bit because of the new low-sulfur fuel. As to 18-wheelers, there's been a lot of improvements. There's some discussion about hybrid technology, though. When you're on the highway, that's a problem. When you're running stop and go, hybrids make sense. They don't work as well when you're just continuing to run because they normally recharge their batteries when you stop or coast, and that doesn't happen on long-distance trips as much. Will we see improvements in fuel economy and emissions from trucks? Yes, there's a lot of new things that could increase that. But again, I think we'll still see diesel will be the dominant fuel there for a long time.
So you're saying that diesel may take a bit of a black eye. Certainly VW are taking a black eye, and it sounds like they have deserved it. Is this going to affect the idea of going green in general? This is not going to be another Solyndra, is it?
No, I don't think it will be. It's interesting because of both the California Air Resource Board's ZEV, or Zero Emission Vehicle Mandate, and in general the much higher fuel economy numbers set by the U.S. EPA, add the CO2 emission standards set by the European Union, new rules in China, in Japan, and on and on and on. Automakers are working their little tails off, trying to come up with cleaner and more fuel-efficient vehicles. Interestingly enough, I was with some of the top dogs of VW and Audi just last week in Frankfurt for the Motor Show, and both brands, they're owned by the same company, of course, both brands, they're top R&D executives confided in me that their plans are to electrify virtually everything they build. I should say essentially all models that they build. That'll range from micro hybrids all the way up to pure battery electric vehicles. And we'll start seeing them in a matter of the next few years. VW is already rolling out a number of battery electric vehicles. Audi showed off an SUV, all electric model called the e-tron, that interestingly enough, should get more mileage than the new Tesla Model S, I'm sorry, Model X sport ute that they're going to be revealing in just a few weeks.
So one of the things that seems a little ironic here is that given the behavior of VW in deceiving so many people in this country and and deceiving the federal government and then deceiving the taxpayer, in as much as we gave subsidies for these cars based upon the idea that they were green when they really weren't as green as they were being advertised. But nevertheless, at their plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, they seem to be a leader in the industry in these right-to-work states of trying to, you know, raise the wages and conditions, working conditions of their employers. They seem to be quite willing to let the United Auto Workers Union get in there, which these other transplants have refused to do. And my understanding is that VW were perfectly willing to have the UAW unionize the Chattanooga plant, but it was the governor of Tennessee and the local politicians that stopped it. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, it is, in fact. It's curious, isn't it? For years, the so-called transplants, factories owned by everybody from Mercedes, BMW to Toyota, Honda, and now Kia and Hyundai, have fought as hard as they could to keep the UAW, United Auto Workers, out. When VW opened its plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee a few years ago, it indicated that it wanted to go with a so-called workers' council, very similar to what they have in Germany. And they, in fact, invited the UAW in, though, you know, they were required to have a vote. Workers did have to vote. And the local politicians, and all the way up to Senator Corker, just got very active in opposing the UAW. In the first vote, the union narrowly lost. There was a big battle. Took it to the National Labor Relations Board and so on. Ultimately, VW said, we don't care, we're inviting the UAW in. But there's also, a non-union union, people opposed to the UAW who have formed another labor group. And so it's an interesting situation where you have two supposed organized labor groups battling to see who will dominate at this VW plant.
Well, Paul Eisenstein, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Eisenstein, who has over 30 years of experience covering the auto industry for a broad range of media. He is the editor and publisher of the DetroitBureau.com and a CNBC contributor. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.